All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today by Judge Toth and Judge Jay Quith. And we're here for the matter of Gloria J. Greer versus Dennis McDonough, docket number 20-3047. Counsel for the parties, state your name and your appearance for the record, please. Thank you, Mr. Carpenter and Ms. Hurl. And Secretary?
May it please the Court, Your Honors, for the record, Shantala Raj on behalf of the Secretary and Deputy Chief Counsel Sarah Fusina.
Thank you, Ms. Raj and Ms. Fusina. As you know, each party has 30 minutes to present argument, and how much time would you like to reserve? Okay, we will make that happen, and you may go ahead, Mr. Carpenter, when you're ready.
May it please the Court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Gloria Greer, who is the substitute appellant for the original appellant, the veteran, Mr. Walter Brink. This matter is before the Court on two questions. The first question deals with whether or not the Board erred as a matter of law when it failed to provide Mr. Brinkman with the notice required by the provisions of 38 U.S.C. 5104B. This court recently, in its decision in Cowan, had this question before it, but chose not to reach it in that decision as to whether or not the requirements of 5104B apply to the board under the AMA. Mr. Brinkman's appeal asked that the panel decide whether or not Section 5104 notice requirements do apply to AMA board decisions. This court in Cowan held that the notice letter itself did not have to contain each of the itemized notice requirements or elements based upon VA's regulation 38 CFR 3.103F. I would suggest to this court that that regulation does not necessarily apply to board decisions because it does not refer to board decisions, nor is it in Chapter 20 for board regulations. It is found in Chapter 3, which pertains to adjudications by the Secretary. Section 103 further does not apply because the form of the notice would require an attachment in any event, because the board decision has attached to it a notice of appellate rights. So anything that would be put in that notice attachment under 5104 would necessarily, or must necessarily, in our view, include all of the specified requirements of the statute. Thus, the sole question before this panel to address is whether or not Section 5104 requirements apply to the board. We believe that it is an undisputed fact that there was no 5104 notice provided to Mr. Brinkman with his decision of January 8, 2020 from the board.
Mr. Carpenter, one of the things Cohen held was that the contents of the decision itself can provide notice. I mean, notice isn't as much a form as it is information itself.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I do not believe that the decision can provide that information. Congress made its intent quite clear, and we cite in our...
Where in the statute would it indicate that the form of notice need be something separate from just the information itself?
Well, as we cite in our brief from the House report, it confirmed the intent that there was an intent to provide notice to help veterans better understand the VA's decision. So if they're understanding the VA decision, it has to be something separate and apart from the decision itself. Because if the decision...
Notice has to be necessarily duplicative information. So there would be all of the information containing all of the reasons and basis for a decision, all the evidence considered, the identification of the issues adjudicated, some of the evidence considered. I mean, a lot of this is in the reasons and basis requirement already. And there would have to be a separate document, all that information basically recapitulated.
Again, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I believe Congress was quite clear in identifying the specific matters that they wanted addressed specifically in the notice, and they are listed 1 through 7 under B of the statute. And it identifies, for example, identification of the issues adjudicated. The board decisions, in my view, do not identify the issues to be adjudicated. For example, in this case, the board decision starts with an order. It doesn't start with the identification of the issue to be adjudicated. Your Honor's observation, in my view, is wrongfully predicated upon the assumption that this information is ascertainable in the notice. And I would suggest that Congress had in mind not whether attorneys or judges could extrapolate from or extract from the decision of the VA or the board.
Let me ask you this. Even tabling whether 5104B applies to the board, would a decision that does not in any meaningful way identify the issues adjudicated pass the reasons in the board? Would the board have satisfied its duties under the reasons in the board, where the decision itself does not even identify the issues adjudicated?
Well, I believe the answer is quite clearly no, Your Honor. It wouldn't. But that is a separate issue. The purpose of notice under the AMA has a separate basis, and that is to inform claimants as to what their next options are. And in this case, what Mr. Brinkman was deprived of was getting to know what his options were based upon these seven elements in a separate notice from the board so that he could make an informed decision as to whether to come to this court or not. Because the only two choices he had was to appeal to this court, which is what he ultimately did, or to file a supplemental claim. Without the information expressly and explicitly articulated in 5104B, no claimant, and by claimant, I'm not referring to the claimant's representative. I'm referring to the pro se appellant who is supposed to be able to understand what the decisions of the VA and in the context of this case, the board, are required to provide him or her in order to make an informed decision as to which of the options to exercise. And by not attaching notice to the board decision, that puts the veteran or claimant at a disadvantage in which one is effectively one of his options is effectively eliminated.
Mr. Carpenter, what's the impact on your argument that 5104 applies, that there's a specific notice provision for board decisions in 7104?
I don't think there's any. I think that they go hand in hand, and that this court needs to recognize that the 7104 notice obligation obviously predated this amendment. And when Congress amended it, this court must presume that Congress understood that there was the 7104 obligation to provide notice. But that provision of notice is substantially different than the provision enacted in the AMA to require notice under 5104B because it identifies seven specific things that must be in that notice. And in the words of the House report, it's in order to have that this bill includes a statutory requirement that VA issued detailed decision notification letters, not detailed decisions, but detail decisions, notification letters, so that in a separate letter, a separate notice to the veteran and the veteran's representative, that the claimant is put on notice of what of the seven specific things the board believes they did. And they have to write down what they did in order to comply with that notice.
And it's your argument that that's in addition to the content of decisions rules and the notice rule.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that frankly, this court cannot reasonably infer that Congress wrote this for no good purpose, that Congress had a clearly expressed purpose, because Congress was redesigning the process. The process is fundamentally different and gives the veteran control through his or her choices. That control was not previously within the veteran or claimant's control. That was within the VA, because you stayed in the cycle of a continuously prosecuted appeal. The enactment of the AMA placed the VA adjudicatory process below the board, not as a new appellate process, but as a re-adjudication process, and that the first two options that are available following a decision at the agency level are a higher-level review or a supplemental claim. That is not an appeal. That is a re-adjudication, placing new and relevant evidence in front of the adjudicator or asking for a de novo review as to presumably questions of law or fact that should have been resolved differently by the decision of the VA. The same holds true for the board.
And doesn't the board's place in the adjudication stream that you just described bring the repeat of the notice provisions that 3.103 causes back into play? You started by saying it didn't apply, but
I'm not sure I'm quite following.
Well,
by bring back into play.
I think it's 3.103F.
3.1, yes.
It spells out the very same notice provisions that are in 5104B. And I thought you opened your argument by disclaiming its application in this case. And I'm wondering why, given that we've continued to apply provisions of 3.103 to the board, including the hearing requirements that apply to the board members' interaction with the claimant. And as you just described, the continuing role of the board in the adjudication stream.
Well, if that's the case, Your Honor, and I'm not sure I agree that it is, and if you want, I'll explain my reasons behind that. But if that is the case, then this court need only apply Cowan to this question and say that 5104B notice must be applied and in accordance with 3.103F, that something else can be attached to a board decision. But quite candidly, Your Honor, that seems at the best redundant, because that's what Congress contemplated. A board decision would get separate notice provided to the claimant in order to allow the claimant to make an informed choice, and then specified those things. The fact that those seven elements are repeated in 3.103F seems purposeless in relationship to the reality of a board decision. Now, what we know from the way in which the VA operates is that they send a notice that includes the rating decision. And what the conclusion was in Cowan was whether or not those two read together can meet the requirements. But there are no read together options in a board decision. A board decision is the final appellate, administrative appellate review by the secretary, the one review by the secretary under 7104. And that is the final decision that is ultimately appealed to this court. But now, with the advent of the AMA, Congress has allowed claimants to take an option that wasn't previously available, and that is within 1 year to return to the agency of original jurisdiction with a supplemental claim with new and relevant evidence. But I submit to you that no claimant is capable of making an informed choice if all of the elements described in the statute are not provided in a notice as contemplated by Congress, a separate notice.
I have one follow-up to the statutory comparison questions we started off with. There was a very recent change, August 10th, I think, to 7104E that inserted the word notice where it didn't previously exist. It just said before, the board shall promptly mail a copy of its written decision to the claimant. Now it says the board shall promptly issue notice of its decision to the appellant. But with that was a new rule of construction, now a note to 38 U.S.C. 5100, saying that none of the amendments made by Section 807 of the PACT Act, including the revised 7104E language, shall be construed to apply Section 5104A to decisions of the board. Sounds like it's meant to address this situation. So my question is, does that have any impact on this case coming as it did months ago?
I guess I'm not quite following your conclusion there, Your Honor. What specifically do you think it implies or suggests?
I'm not sure what it implies or suggests, but what it says is that the amendments that it makes, including the revised 7104E language, that it shall not be construed to apply Section 5104A to board decisions. So if that means what it sounds like it could mean, it could be an attempt to write out the arguments that you're making in this case. And so that's why I'm asking you about it.
And you're saying that by that action of Congress, this court might be able to infer an intent on the part of Congress not to provide this notification. And I would say
it could be argued.
Yeah, it could be, Your Honor. And I think that argument would be wrong. And the reason that argument is wrong is the same reason that the Secretary is wrong about what a board decision is. It is a 511 decision of the Secretary affecting benefits. And it is quite literally the penultimate decision affecting benefits because it is the final VA decision on a claim unless something else is done. And the whole purpose of the AMA was to provide options to the veteran. So the veterans would not have to appeal to this court, but could, if adequately informed, present a new and relevant evidence so that they could continue to proceed before the Secretary, as opposed to come before this court and face a much more difficult challenge in undoing a board decision. So it seems to me that while Your Honor is correct that it could be interpreted that way, I think that would be an incorrect interpretation because the same language that is used in 7104, with a few minor discrepancies, is the language used in 5104, and that is a decision of the Secretary. And when a decision of the Secretary is made, 5104B notice is required. And to allow the Secretary to get off of that responsibility is to place claimants at a fundamental disadvantage. I see that I'm close to the time about halfway, and I really want to get to the second issue in my appeal and not spend, although I could, the additional time before you on that. So unless there's further questions about the 5104 notice provisions from the panel, I will take that as no. The next issue, Your Honors, is Mr. Brinkman, in his brief, also argued that the veterans law judge was no more competent to determine whether medical evidence met the requirements of a diagnostic code than he or she would be to determine whether or not a trust document meets the requirements of the VA regulation to exclude or deny pension benefits, which is precisely what happened in this case. The veterans law judge made two critical legal determinations, which we believe were must be understood to have been interpretations of this trust document. The first was that Mr. Brinkman's trust revealed, according to the veterans law judge, that the purpose of the trust is, in fact, to provide financial assistance to the veteran during his lifetime and to maximize the government and public assistance to the veteran while preserving the estate.
So your argument is basically that the VLJ would have moved us the assistance of an expert witness to make this finding. Is
yes.
that okay? I mean, I have a couple of questions about that. I mean, first of all, how is that not the development of evidence? I mean, this is, if I'm correct, this is the direct review lane, right? The lane that Ms. Greer is in the lane where there's no evidence submitted. It's just on the record before the AOJ. Am I correct about that?
In the appeal that he took from the decision that denied him pension.
Right.
Is that what? Yes, John. That is
okay. So I mean, let's imagine the shoe were on the other foot. And if say the board member got the case and said, you know, this is kind of a tricky issue. I'm gonna ask for an expert witness to help me out, and then would have denied the claim based on the testimony of the expert witness. How would that not be the improper development of evidence?
Well, because the problems we have with what the board judge did in this case was that the board judge made interpretations of the meaning of the trust document.
That's what a judge is meant to do. I mean,
with all due respect, Your Honor, I do not believe that is correct. That is correct in the adversarial system. We are in a non-adversarial system, and the board judge is supposed to be reviewing the record to determine.
Adversarial or otherwise, I mean, a board member can't outsource the findings of fact to, especially about legal conclusions, to another party. I mean, Congress hasn't allowed anybody else to issue fact findings. The reason with the medical issue is it's implicitly a factual finding. Whereas, you know, under Daubert, under all these things, if it's a complex factual issue, you can get the assistance of an expert witness. But courts don't have experts testifying legal issues because that would just confuse the jury.
But Your Honor, this is not a jury that is being confused. This is a veterans law judge who does not have the basic competence to make a medical decision without evidence in the record to support that decision. And I'm simply asking that the rule in Coven be extended to the legal question in this case of whether or not a trust agreement does or does not do what the veterans law judge says. Because basically what we have now is a veterans law judge who has no competence to examine.
I mean, the veterans law judge is a lawyer. So I don't, I mean, the basis of Colvin was, hey, VLJs, or board members as they were called then, are not doctors. And no, they're not. But I mean, here it's just the lawyer making a legal conclusion about the meaning of an irrevocable trust or the impact of an irrevocable trust on net worth or income. I mean, how is that outside the area of their expertise in general?
Because their expertise has nothing to do with reviewing legal documents to see whether they do or do not comply with the requirements of VA regulations. And the VA regulation in this case is whether or not the trust document causes the assets to stay in the trust or are not part of the trust. And the judgment call that was made was that the veterans law judge said they were outside of the term.
Right, and you disagree with that conclusion of the VLJ, but that doesn't mean, that might just mean the VLJ made an erroneous determination. It doesn't mean that they don't have the necessary expertise to draw a conclusion in this area of law.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, there's a 58-page trust document. And I think everybody in this room who has a law degree can agree that our individual abilities to examine that trust document to determine what is or isn't included is a formidable task. That is not the kind of task as to looking at a relatively simple legal question, such as, were there an adequate statement of reasons or bases in the board's
competency doesn't. I mean, it doesn't hinge on the complexity of the task, right? I mean, competency, like, the reason VLJs need medical assistance is they just never went to medical school. It's not because certain medical questions are difficult or certain medical questions are less difficult. I mean, it's all medical questions, they would benefit from assistance. I don't see how that...
Right, but Congress also provided by statute for medical advisory opinions, where the opinion was of sufficient complexity. And so the question of complexity has been addressed by Congress. And it seems to me that when we're talking about a 58-page legal document and a veterans law judge makes conclusions that are simply not supported by the text, that it goes beyond the question of simply making it wrong.
I mean, even with an expert, I mean, how would an expert understand VA regulations? Because that's the other half of the equation, is matching the testamentary document to the VA regs.
The question for the expert would be, what does it say? And that the veterans law judge could pose specific questions like you do for an advisory medical opinion, and then have those questions conveyed to the claimant so that the claimant would have an opportunity to understand and potentially get a expert to refute whatever conclusion there was. The relevant question in this case is, were these assets in the trust and therefore protected and not part of his corpus, part of his net worth, or were they outside of it? And if they were outside of it, then he should have been granted the benefit. And an expert...
Don, let's add another 5 minutes, please.
And an expert simply would assist the board judge in making the determination with the evidence from the expert as to what was included and what was excluded. Now, if this is in fact the trust that the veterans law judge says it was, then clearly Mr. Brinkman was not entitled to the benefit. But this trust does not say the things that the veterans law judge said it did, such as provided legal assistance to the veteran for his lifetime. That language isn't in the trust. And I agree, Judge Bartley, we could have taken an entirely different tact and simply attacked that finding, and then ask this court to review this 58-page document and determine whether or not that language was or was not in there. But it seemed in Mr. Brinkman's interest and any other person who is in the circumstance that Mr. Brinkman is, where you have to go outside and disinvest yourself, if you will, from your assets in an irrevocable trust. This is an irrevocable trust, and the veterans law judge, it's right in the document. It says it's an irrevocable trust. He said it wasn't an irrevocable trust, that he could get into it and have money paid to him.
Congress, you were talking about the IMEs, the independent medical expert opinions. Congress provided that ability through statute and said, when you have these complex issues, board, you can go outside and get an opinion. But they haven't done so for complex legal issues. What kind of authority, if we wanted to write an opinion that provided that, what kind of authority would we rely on?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that authority is within your sound discretion. As you created the rule of law in Colvin, there is no provision from Congress that says that board members will not be able to render decisions without competent medical evidence. That's not in any statute. So this court did in Colvin precisely what I'm asking this court to do in the context of a complex legal document. But if you had the authority to do it in Colvin, I'm submitting you have the authority to do it here. Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't the other tack that you forswore to do, to proceed this way more consonant with our role? Or put another way, doesn't our review of the board's decision encompass the board member's competence in the context of what is at issue, the board's decision in the case at hand, by reviewing the adequacy of his findings and conclusions and the stated reasons or bases for them, including his analysis of the evidence?
I assure you, Your Honor, I didn't look at it that way. But as you presented, I think one could make that argument. But if this court has a rule of law in Colvin that limits the scope of the activity of a veterans law judge, there is no reason not to impose a similar limitation in the context of a complex legal document, which is really the deciding factor in this case as to the entitlement to pension. Now, one other very quick observation, I see I'm running out of time again, is that the
happens to all of us.
Well, I have another question. It might take you further afield, not back to it, but and it is that just last year the court addressed this question in our line and declined to equate vocational matters mm-hmm. with medical issues. So why should we equate legal questions with medical issues, especially since, as the chief pointed out, board members have some expertise in the law. And if they have any with respect to trust, you would think it would be in this area, a trust measured against VA standards.
And I recalled what I was just forgot.
Happy to be of help.
The Congress did, literally within a matter of 60 days following the application in this case, create an objective legal standard, which was previously not available for decisions relative to pension, and adopted the 123-600 number for what constitutes a net worth in order to qualify for pension benefits. It takes out all of the things that existed pre that determination, and this case is the perfect example in which there is no objective number. There is no regulation that says, as it now says, 123.6 is the number. If you have 123.6 of net value, you do not qualify. It says you can take into consideration income, you can take into consideration these other things, but it does not say at the end of the day, where's the demarcation? Where's the line in the sand at which you no longer qualify? And relies instead on the judgment of the adjudicator, or in this case, the board judge, which is why it's important, even though this court went the other way in our line, to have this type of rule, because there needs to be a limitation when there is no criteria. Now, this rule may never apply again based upon the change in the law. And the irony in this case, Your Honors, I have to say, and I didn't realize this until I was preparing for the argument, is that this decision could have been granted based upon the new law, because it was just year one, or I believe it was 2018, that would have applied under the old statute. In 2019, 2020, and 21, before his death, the new law should have been applied and was not applied by the board. But this whole case turns on a decision by the veterans law judge that in this set of facts, with this particular trust, he was excluded because the trust provided things that the trust simply does not provide. And that was an unsubstantiated opinion, just like in Colvin, of what the legal evidence meant. And there was no other description in the record of what that legal evidence meant. Unless there's further questions from the panel, I'm happy to sit down.
Great.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Ms. Raj, you may go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Your Honors. The Secretary concedes that remand is warranted for the Board to resolve some factual and legal issues consistent with what is in our brief. But the Court should reject Appellant's other arguments. As to Appellant's argument that revised 38 U.S.C. Section 5104B applies to the Board, the Secretary urges the Court to reject that argument for the following three reasons. First, the plain meaning of the phrase, decision by the Secretary, is clear that it refers to AOJ decisions when statutory section 5104 is read harmoniously with other statutes, such as 38 U.S.C. sections 511 and 7104. Second, congressional intent is clear that the amendment to 5104B was to, quote, better inform the veteran's decision regarding whether to appeal VA's rating decision. And third, even if the Court believes that 5104B is genuinely ambiguous, it should then defer to the Secretary's implementing regulation, 38 CFR Section 3.103, which interprets 5104B as applying only to AOJ decisions. With respect to Appellant's other argument that the Court should expand its holding in Colvin, the Secretary urges the Court to reject that argument for the following two reasons. First, the Board is required by law and a precedential GC opinion to address the contents and value of a trust because pension is a needs-based benefit. Second, this Court's holding in Colvin is limited to medical determinations. In contrast, the Board is competent to review evidence, including legal documents. Turning to the proper interpretation of 5104B, this question hinges on the meaning of the phrase decision by the Secretary. The Secretary's position is that this unambiguously refers to AOJ decisions. A harmonious reading of the relevant statute supports this conclusion. Initially, Section 511A indicates that a decision by the Secretary will decide all necessary questions of law and fact under a law affecting the provision of benefits to veterans and their dependents.
So I want to ask you about this. If we were to kind of split the proverbial atom here, and looking at 511, if we were to say that decisions of by the Secretary would only be read to be an AOJ decision, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think it would fundamentally change how we would read 38 U.S.C. 511, right? Under that reading, you could make an argument that the Secretary shall decide all questions of law and fact necessary to a decision by the Secretary under a law that affects the provision of benefits by the Secretary of Veterans or Dependents or Survivors of Veterans, but that language could mean that really only the AOJ could issue factual findings, right? And then even later, the next sentence, subject to subsection B, the decision of the Secretary as to any such question shall be final and conclusive and may not be reviewed by any other official or by any court, whether by an action, nature of men. That would seem to include the Board. I mean, if the Board's not a decision of the Secretary, I don't see how that would be, in a sense, reviewable if we were to narrow that definition to kind of a term of art.
Your Honor, the Secretary's response would be that it's not just a matter of looking at it at just 511. Viewing 511 and reading it harmoniously with 5104 and 7104 leads to additional context for 511. Section 5104 notes that in the case of a decision by the Secretary under 511, the Secretary shall provide notice of that decision as well as include an explanation of the procedure for obtaining review. But then when looking at 7104A, Your Honor, that indicates that a decision by the Secretary shall be subject to one review on appeal to the Secretary, with final decisions on such appeals shall be made by the Board.
Right. I mean, to me, it's clear that across a couple of different statutory provisions that there's sort of a broader reading of a decision by the Secretary as being sort of the final decision of the Secretary, the ultimate decision of the Secretary. There's indications where there's more of a narrow reading where it's a term of art. So, for instance, like 5109A and 7111 seem to suggest that, that in those contexts, the term decision by the secretary would be the AOJ, right? Because why would 7111 exist for Q, for a board decision, as opposed to... But those provisions don't specifically tie to the Section 511, whereas 5104 does. So does 7104. It says, in the case of a decision under Section 511, right, that under Section 511 is not in Section 7111. It's not in... It's in Section 7104. It's not in 5109A. So that seems to suggest that when it's using the narrower term of art, it's not referencing back to the 511, because, again, my opening question is, your definition would sort of wreak havoc with 511, which would be the board would be something separate from the secretary. And the board may not even, under 511, have authority to even review decisions of the AOJ. Do you see the fundamental problem I'm pointing to?
Yes, 1 minute, Your Honor.
There's a lot in there, so we can kind of take it down into steps. If you look at 5109A and 7111, so that's the Q provisions, right? And so in Q, for instance, the AOJ can't sua sponte kind of initiate review of a board decision, right? And so there's separate Q provisions for the AOJ decision and then for the board, right? And in those cases, like under 5109A, they refer to the secretary of decision in the way that you're talking about it. It seems to be a sort of term of art that would reflect something like an AOJ decision. But that appears to be different from the way it's used in 5104 and 7104 and 511, where the decision of the secretary is just the ultimate overall decision of VA, on the granting of benefits.
Your Honor, the secretary would assert that 7104 clarifies that a board decision is a review on appeal of a decision by the secretary. And that's why it goes back to this idea that it's not just about looking at 511. It's looking at 511 harmoniously in conjunction.
Right, but we can't read out 511. I mean, 511 basically says the decision by the secretary is final and shall not be reviewed by any other official. The board's separate from the secretary. If the board's not included in that decision of the secretary, they almost lack any jurisdiction to even hear the matter, right? I mean, even our court, it would call into question our court because we're sort of contingent on a board decision.
I would point the court to Bates versus Nicholson, where the Federal Circuit indicated that an interpretation of Section 511A generally places review of secretarial decisions under a single piece of legislation relating in part or in whole to benefits first in the board and then in the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, which clearly serves the congressional purpose of 511. And I think that still kind of goes back hand in hand with what the Secretary's position is about the harmonious reading of 511, 5104, and 7104, which is that 511 sets forth this decision by the Secretary, 5104 sets forth the notice that needs to be provided by the decision of a secretary, and then 7104A makes it clear that all questions in a matter under Section 511A are first subject to a decision by the secretary and then subject to one review on appeal, with final decisions on such appeals being made by the board, which in the secretary's view means that the board is rendering a final decision on the appeal of an AOJ decision. So viewing these three statutes harmoniously would mean that the phrase decision by the secretary would refer to an AOJ decision. However, it is not just a matter of the language of the statutes. Even more clearly, the secretary's position is supported by legislative intent, because going back to the House Committee on Veterans Affairs 2017 report accompanying the AMA, specifically at page 3, in regards to the revised 5104B that took place under the new AMA statutory scheme, Congress stated, the intent of this provision is to better help inform the veteran's decision regarding whether to appeal VA's rating decision. This is a very specific statement. These are very specific words, the use of the words rating decision. Congress made these changes based on the AMA's changes and underlying purpose to give veterans more appeal options. And so these additional requirements in 5104B for rating decision content are to help veterans decide whether and how to appeal the rating decision. And notably, that House report doesn't make any reference to the board or board decisions in its discussion. And presumably, Congress was aware of 7104, as well as its implementing regulation 20.801, which cover board decision content.
Excuse me, Ms. Raj, but the Senate report does. It picks up on a point Mr. Carpenter raised by saying that if the board decision was not favorable but helped the veteran understand what evidence was needed to support the claim, then the veteran would have 1 year to submit new and relevant evidence to the AOJ in a supplemental claim without fearing an effective date penalty for choosing to go to the board first. So it seems to contemplate that the 5104B does apply to the board.
Your Honor, the Secretary is aware of the report. The Secretary's position is that that still would go in tandem with 7104, which covers jurisdiction of the board and notice, as well as adequate reasons and bases, and then by extension, the existing body of case law dedicated to providing an adequate statement of reasons and bases to facilitate both review by the veteran, understanding by the veteran, as well as effective judicial review.
But don't you admit that 7104 is, it, seen in light of 5104, is deficient? I mean, 5104, you know, says you're going that whatever decision we're talking about has to identify the elements not satisfied and also give the veteran or the claimant information about what criteria they need to satisfy the requirements of law. And 7104 doesn't provide any of that, even though it does have a, you know, it's a like a tamped-down notice provision.
Your Honor, the Secretary would assert that board decisions are already required to identify the criteria not satisfied in the process of issuing a board decision that provides adequate reasons and bases. I think the best example would be for the purposes of just hypotheticals, would be an IRPTSD case where the board has to lay out what the criteria are, the successive criteria required to be met. And board decisions generally will put out what are the 50%, what are the 70%, what are the 100% criteria, and then subsequently should follow it with an analysis of how the evidence does or does not meet that criteria. So a board decision would be identifying the criteria not met.
So but part of Mr. Carpenter's argument, I believe, was that the board decision here did not indicate how he could, if necessary, to meet the requirement, how he could change the irrevocable trust provisions to make it compliant somehow with, so that his income would be, for VA purposes, would be, or net worth would be low enough.
Initially, the Secretary notes that we conceded remand for the board to provide adequate reasons and bases on that regulatory change to address the change in net worth, kind of consonant with what the decision in Dejean kind of decided, because it was the board made a conclusion about the net worth but then didn't say anything about whether or not this new regulation applied. And presumably within any kind of remanded decision, the board would then be expected to provide an adequate statement of reasons or bases. However, in this particular situation, that there was no identification of whether or not the new regulations, i.e. the criteria, applied. So we were asking the board to go back and provide us additional reasons and bases to be more helpful and provide us with context in the first instance.
Well, that's interesting information, but I don't think it goes to the argument that was being made, which is if the irrevocable trust here was not compliant to screen that those funds from inclusion into net worth or income, how could he make it that way? Or is that impossible? I mean, so the board decision didn't give any of that information.
Your Honor, looking at Section 5104B, looking at the elements of notice, the element number five is that if there is a denial, there is an identification of the unsatisfied elements. The subsequent sixth element is how to obtain or access evidence used to make the decision, and then, if applicable, ID criteria that has to be satisfied. And I think in this particular situation, asking the board to provide legal advice on how to fix the trust is not necessarily the same thing as identifying the criteria. In this particular case, the criteria is what is your net worth? And the turning issue for which we considered remand was net worth calculated properly? How do the regulations apply? And so in terms of that, the identification of the criteria, which is your net worth needs to be X, or if it's not X, it's not met, that is identified within the board decision. And then that would be what we think 5104 is asking. 5104B is asking.
Well, I would just go back to your point, which seemed to be that 7104 is somehow comparable, full enough to encompass a lot of the elements that are listed in 5104. And I'm basically pointing out, like, not really. they're very different.
If the court exhausts its toolbox of textual analysis and ultimately concludes that 5104 is genuinely ambiguous, then the Secretary would assert that the court should defer to its interpretation of the implementing regulation as demonstrated through 38 CFR section 3.103, and in particular 3.103F. We would note that 3.103F largely mirrors 5104B. The first seven elements more or less equate to the seven elements in 5104B, and then looking at the eighth criteria, that provides a summary of the reviews available to a claimant under 3.2500A, and those reviews are higher level review, board appeal, or supplemental claim, which the Secretary asserts goes back to this idea that the phrase decision by the Secretary was interpreted by the Secretary as applying to AOJ decisions and not board decisions. And even to take it a step further, looking at the regulatory history, if we look at the proposed rule amending 3.103, that indicates at 83 FR 39818 that enhanced decision notices will allow for more informed choices about seeking further review and which lane, a supplemental claim with the AOJ, higher level review of the initial AOJ decision, or an appeal to the board. And again, that is going back to this idea that the Secretary has interpreted this phrase decision by the Secretary as applying to AOJ decisions and not board decisions. Even further, in the final rule, at 84 FR 138 at 139, VA explains that in accordance with the AMA and 3.103F, they provide information to the claimant in the initial decision regarding what evidence considered, which goes to show that VA interpreted 3.103, which implements 5104B, as applying to AOJ decisions. Further, looking at the final rule that addresses 20.801, and that's 84 FR 138 at 140, VA states that 7104B3 is consonant with VA's decision to not impose requirements on VBA to list or summarize untimely evidence. This provision is necessary to comply with 38 U.S.C. section 7104 subsection D number 2, which is specific to board decisions and only requires a broad statement that untimely evidence, which was received and not considered, rather than any meaningful engagement with that evidence, such as listing or summarizing the evidence. This shows that the board now has to state what evidence is not considered because it was submitted after the record was closed. There is no similar requirement for the agency of original jurisdiction. So now, because we are in an AMA framework, there are different requirements for the board and the agency of original jurisdiction. So again, if the court exhausts its toolbox of textual analysis to include not just the canons of construction, but to also be looking at congressional intent, and finds that 5104B language is genuinely ambiguous, the Secretary's own implementing regulation, along with its regulatory history, shows that the Secretary interpreted 5104B as applying to AOJ decisions and not board decisions. And so the Secretary would urge the court to defer to the Secretary's
interpretation. So what do you make about case law? I mean, I'm looking at a case, Rossler and Thompson, from the 90s, that said 5104A applies to the board.
So that was, Your Honor, the Secretary would say that that was in the 1990s. We are now in a prior statutory scheme. We are now in a new statutory scheme.
There's a lot of cases from the 90s I'd love to ignore, but that's just not a basis for...
Certainly, Your Honor. In the process of implementing and creating this new statutory scheme, Congress has given us context through that 2017 House Committee report. And again, the Secretary would point the court to the use of the phrase rating decision. And the Secretary keeps coming back.
It would look like we would have to effectively overrule Thompson because the notice applies. B just basically outlines the contents of what the notice would be. I mean, there's no other way around it. I mean, is there any other way around, basically, our precedent that says 5104A, which is the notice, the board's bound by the notice provision, is applicable?
The Secretary is still of the position that a harmonious reading of 511, 5104, and 7104 together still point to the idea that the phrase decisions of the Secretary refers to AOJ decisions and not board decisions.
Do you have 511 in front of you? I know this will be a bit pedantic, but just to show you, I mean, this is fundamental. This is the central statutory provision of all of Title 38, and it basically says the Secretary shall decide all questions of law and fact necessary to a decision by the Secretary. What you're saying is that provision, A, 511, only applies to AOJ decisions, right? Because the second sentence would be subject to the decision of the Secretary as to any such question shall be final and conclusive and may not be reviewed by any other official or any court. That if the board is not rolled into the definition of decision of the Secretary, they simply cannot review the AOJ decision. I mean, that reads the board out of existence. Now, I can see, I mean, I could advocate a kind of a milder version of what you're saying, which is that it's possible there are complementary notions of what the term decision by the Secretary means, that in one sense, one would be a broader one that would include all the agencies within VA that are delegated to, you know, make benefits determinations, AOJs, DROs, the board, the director of competency, whomever, that they would all be sort of rolled up into the decision of the Secretary. In other areas like 5109A or 711, it's clear that they're using a term of art which would really be a narrower version of that. But there's no way I can get to a reading where the board is fundamentally excluded from the definition of decision by the Secretary, because that would cause massive problems in the whole statutory scheme. I mean, just see what I'm getting at?
Your Honor, the Secretary does see where Your Honor is getting at. However, we still have this legislative intent that is specifying the purpose of revised 5104B. We are still looking at this harmonious reading that uses this phrase decision by the Secretary first in 511, then in 5104 for the purposes of indicating what notice on a decision by the Secretary will provide. But then 7104 makes it clear that a review on appeal of a decision by the Secretary with such a final decision being made by the board translates to the board decision is a review or a decision on a review of an appeal of an AOJ decision. And so that is what the Secretary is coming back to. And this is clearly what Congress was kind of talking about in terms of providing more appeal options in that House committee report were going back to this idea of providing more options at the AOJ initial decision level, leading to these evidentiary lanes, like should I choose higher level review? Should I appeal directly to the board? Should I choose direct or evidentiary review, or should I choose a hearing lane? And this complicated
notice. Isn't one of those option choices, excuse me, the supplemental claim that involves circling back from the board, so it still puts the board right in the middle of all this?
Yes, Your Honor, but the Secretary would assert that 7104, as well as its implementing regulation 20.801, is what covers the notice of board decisions, as well as ensuring that the content of the board decision is such that the veteran is able to understand the decision, the issues on appeal, the criteria, and then make a decision.
But this, it's not a written symphony, apparently, because the harmonization efforts are still occurring. The word notice doesn't even appear in 7104 until August 10th.
And, Your Honor, I would put to the court that the fact that it showed up in August 10th shows an attempt to kind of create that reconciliation. So maybe that reconciliation...
Or affect the outcome of this case.
Potentially, Your Honor, yes. But the fact that we now have this updated information as of August goes back to this idea of the board and the AOJ are separate. And so the board is issuing that review on the appeal of the AOJ decision, hence the 5104B notice, which leads to all of these various lanes, is sufficiently complicated to correspond, and not complicated, I apologize, Your Honors, detailed to give more context to the veteran as to what lane to choose, which way to go. Whereas with the board decision, you're either appealing to this court or you're filing a supplemental claim. And so looking at 7104, that's covering what the board is required to do, whereas this more complicated notice as set forth by 5104B, because there are so many different lanes that a veteran can choose in appealing that decision, it makes sense that it would fall in tandem with that.
But one of the post-board lanes is the same as one of the AOJ to board lanes, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And also at the RO you have three lanes, and at the board you have two. So it's not like there's after the board decision you have two. So it's not like there's that's not a huge difference between two and three.
Your Honor, the Secretary would say that being able to choose not just a direct appeal to the board, but being able to choose a direct review lane, a hearing lane, an evidentiary lane, not even just I'm appealing to the board, but I can choose the method by which I appeal to the board. That's a complication that exists now under AMA to provide a veteran with more options to kind of decide what's best for me. And so 5104B notice and the details provided within 5104B notice serve to provide additional context to help a veteran decide which of those choices, even not just, I'm going to appeal to the board, but what's the lane by which I choose to apply to the board. 5104B notice provides that context to help a veteran make a determination about, okay, it's not just a matter of appealing to the board, it's how am I going to appeal to the board. Your Honors, I see that I have a little bit over a minute and a half left, and I would like an opportunity to provide a bit of argument on the second portion of this, and unless the court has any additional questions for me.
Go ahead.
Certainly. Turning to the second argument, Your Honor, the Secretary urges the court to reject any attempt to expand Colvin, initially noting that 38 U.S.C. sections 1522A, as well as implementing regulation 3.276, require a discontinuation of the pension if the net worth is greater than a set limit. In particular, the Secretary emphasizes that per subsection B of 3.276, the policy statement, the general policy statement, is that pension is a needs-based benefit, which is not for the purposes of preserving large estates. And as a result, the secretary is required to evaluate net worth and assets. The precedential GC opinion 33-97 further expands on 3.276B. After initially noting that Medicaid benefits have been used by persons with large estates for the purpose of preserving those estates for the use of their heirs and beneficiaries, GC opinion 33-97, I believe I'm out of time.
You can finish your less than a minute, though.
Certainly. GC opinion 33-97 makes it clear that any unilateral language in a trust attempting to shield assets has no legal impact on VA's determination of entitlement to benefits. And I would point the court to record at 86 through 87, where the trust language clearly states that the intent of the trust is to maximize a collection of benefits and for the trust to supplement his other benefits, which initially goes against 3.276B, and then subsequently in the supplemental needs trust at record at 89, the trust states that no part of the principal or undistributed income of the supplemental needs trust should be considered available for benefits purposes. This is exactly the type of unilateral declaration that the precedential opinion indicates does not affect how VA determines entitlements to benefits. And as was noted earlier by the court, just as in Arline, the court declined to equate vocational assessments with medical issues, I think a parallel argument can be found in TDIU adjudication. The board is not required to get a market survey on employment, and it's not to outsource its adjudicatory functions to others under the guise of sufficient legal expertise, and I believe that was this court's holding in Del Rio. And so the secretary would urge the court to decline to expand its holding in Colvin to encompass trust documents. And in conclusion, the secretary urges the court only to remand for the board to resolve factual and legal issues consistent with the concessions made in the secretary's brief, as well as to further reject appellant's arguments regarding the applicability of Section 5104B and the expansion of its holding in Colvin.
Do you have any questions? Okay, thank you, Ms. Raj. Mr. Carpenter, you may move ahead with rebuttal.
I'd like to begin with the assertion of the government that there is an issue of ambiguity here. There simply is no ambiguity in the language of 5104B. There is no ambiguity in 5104A. 5104A, like 7104A, refers expressly to a decision of the secretary. What the government has done is to ignore, not just, as Judge Toth pointed out, the decisions of this court, which have held that decisions of the board are subject to 5104 notice, but has ignored the Federal Circuit's decision in Cummings, which held the exact same thing. In Cummings, the Federal Circuit decided that the notice that was being provided was adequate, because that's all that was required under the prior version of 5104. Excuse me, it was very limited and very narrow. The notice that is required now is just the opposite. The pendulum has swung.
Can I ask you about that?
Yes.
So we've discussed, obviously, whether the notice provision applies to the board, and then we've discussed the form of the notice, and I understand your position on those two. The substance of the notice, How does 5104B expand on what we're basically kind of our case law as to what the reasons and bases duties entail? Because obviously there's a lot of overlap. So what substantively new material has 5104B introduced to the board?
Well, I believe it has to do with the intent of Congress to fundamentally change and modernize the appeal process.
Sure. I understand the form and all that, but in terms of content, like what actual information do they have to share that they didn't already have to under the reasons and bases requirement?
I would submit to you, Your Honor, that the seven items under 5104B cannot be equated to reasons or bases. that reasons or bases have to do with whether or not the decision of the board can be understood by the appellant and can be understood by this court. And if those reasons and bases do not convey that understanding, then this court will not review such a decision. Fundamentally different is the notice that's provided in 5104B. 5104B identifies seven specific things that are to be discussed by the board after the
decision. I don't mean to push back, but I'm hearing nothing in the sense of, I understand your argument, which is that, okay, this notice, but this to me speaks more to form. Again, and we've already discussed form, I understand your position, but none of this really addresses substance. I mean, is there anything here that wouldn't already be included in the reasons and bases?
Number one, the identification of the issues adjudicated. The board has an obligation, whether they include it in their decision or not, to identify in a separate notice the specific issues that were adjudicated. And that would necessarily include not just the ultimate issue, but any ancillary issues, such as a predicate for a presumption.
So maybe the substantive thing is maybe greater clarity, right? Maybe more specificity.
And clarity is at the heart of this, because the purpose of the AMA is to allow the claimant to make informed decisions. And a claimant cannot make informed decisions without these seven items expressly detailed.
But your point is none of these are necessarily new. They're just,
are necessarily what you're...
I mean, none of these would necessarily have been excluded from the reasons and basis requirement, if I'm understanding you correctly. None of it is, you know, this, it's just a matter of the maybe the level of detail and the form. That's kind of the crux of your argument.
Well, Your Honor, Congress laid out expectations in 5104B. Those expectations did not exist. They did not exist in the case law or any regulation prior to...
Yeah, no, I'm not... I understand, because I'm not... Really, I'm not disputing any of that. It doesn't... But I'm just asking just about content. Like, literally, if they introduced anything that wasn't already kind of covered in our precedent regarding reasons and bases.
Well, Your Honor, if the global... shadow of reasons or bases is that enormous, then clearly it covers all seven of these items. The point is these seven items were not previously required to be disclosed by the board or by the AOJ in the original decision.
So maybe something like number seven, right, you could say is not automatically covered in our case law. That might be maybe the express identification of criteria for the next higher level.
Well, Your Honor, I would also say findings favorable to the claimant. Findings favorable to the claimant is not part of this court's case law. This court's case law says in terms of a favorable finding made by the board is binding on this court, pursuant to Medrano. But this has a corresponding statutory provision that says any favorable finding is binding on every other adjudicator.
Good. I mean, that's responsive. That is substantively different.
I'd like to go back to Judge Jake with your point. I've had a chance to look at E. And E, in its text, not in the ancillary document, makes reference parenthetically that the term issue is defined in Section 5100 of the title. Now, I agree there are qualifications, as you suggested, but it says after reaching a decision on appeal, the board shall promptly issue notice. So something has to be accompanying that board decision, and we assert that something is 5104B. I had one other point, and I've forgotten it. I won't attempt to recall it. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter, and we thank both parties for their arguments, and the case is submitted for consideration. We will come down and greet counsel.
All rise.